previous season had come from Charles Oakley, who had averaged 14.5 points and 13.7 rebounds, and John Paxson, who had 11.3 points while shooting almost 49% from the floor. The thing you had to do with Michael Jordan is you had to gain his confidence as a player, Paxson explained. You had to do something that gave him some trust in you as a player. He was hard on teammates as far as demanding you play hard, you execute. So there had to come some point where you did something on the floor to earn his trust. That was the hardest thing for new guys coming in, and some guys couldn't deal with it. Some guys could not play consistently enough or well enough, or they would not do the dirty work or little things. That's one of the reasons why Michael liked Charles Oakley, because Charles played hard. He did little things on the floor that Michael appreciated, but a lot of guys didn't understand that. Pippen. The first time he met Pippen, Jordan looked at him and said, "Oh great, another country boy." It was an apparent reference to Pete Myers, Krause's sixth-round pick out of the University of Arkansas in 1986. Pippen came from the neighboring university, Central Arkansas. "I'd never heard of him," Jordan said of Pippen. "He was from an NAIA school." Pippen was from Hamburg, Arkansas, a former railroad town of about 3,000 people that was also the home of True Grit author Charles Portis. Pippen was the baby of Preston and Ethel Pippen's 12 children. Preston Pippen worked in a textile mill, but his health failed during Scotty's high school years, perhaps limiting the opportunities for his youngest child. Pippen mostly sat the bench as a junior at Hamburg High, but he started at point guard as a 6'1", 150-pound senior. For the second leg of his improbable basketball journey, his high school coach arranged for him to attend Central Arkansas as a team manager, a role Pippen had served in high school. "I was responsible for taking care of the equipment, jerseys, stuff like that," he once recalled. "I always enjoyed doing that, just being a regular manager." His raw talent soon registered with basketball coach Don Dyer. "He wasn't recruited by anyone," Dyer once explained. "He was a walk-on, a 6'1½", 150-pound walk-on. His high school coach, Donald Wayne, played for me in college, and I took Pippen as a favor to him. I was prepared to help him through college. I was going to make him manager of the team and help him make it financially through college. When Scotty showed up for college, he had grown to 6'3". I had had a couple of players leave school. I could see a little potential. He was like a young colt. An NBA career had never even crossed Pippen's mind, not even in his dreamiest moment. But he had grown to 6'5 by the end of that freshman year and had established that he was one of the team's best players. "He had a point guard mentality," Dyer told the Chicago Tribune in explaining Pippen's evolution, "and we used him to bring the ball up the floor against the press. But I also played him in forward, center, all over the floor." Scottie Pippen began to understand that things were different on the basketball floor. "I could be as good as I wanted to be. I developed confidence in my abilities." He blossomed into a two-time NAIA All-American. His senior year brought the kind of performance that got the attention of Marty Blake, the NBA's director of scouting. Pippen averaged 23.6 points, 10 rebounds, and 4.3 assists while shooting 59% from the floor and 58% from three-point range. Blake passed information about Pippen on to the Bulls and other teams. Pippen was invited to one of the NBA's tryout camps in Virginia, the Portsmouth Invitational, where Krause fell in love, as scouts are known to do. For one thing, now a full 6'7", Pippen had exceedingly long arms, which had long been a key for Krause in his evaluation of players. "We watched him," Krause later recalled, "and I just got excited. I just got really shook up bad." From there, Pippen was headed to the NBA's next camp in Hawaii. Krause notified Collins that they had a hot prospect. "When we told Doug Collins about Scotty, he was skeptical," Krause said. "So I put together a video of all the players in the Hawaii tournament and gave it to the coaches. I gave them names and rosters, but no real information on the players. We let them see for themselves. After they came out of the video session, I asked if they had any questions, and the first thing out of their mouths was, 'Who the hell is Scottie Pippen?'" From there, Krause worked a somewhat complicated deal with Seattle that netted Pippen for Chicago after the Sonics had selected him fifth overall in the 1987 draft. In return, Seattle got Olden Polynice, a center out of the University of Virginia. As a player from a small town and a small school who was suddenly thrust into the spotlight in Chicago, Pippen was understandably lost. "He was a phenomenal talent, but he was just so raw," Jim Stack recalled. "And Scotty, when we first drafted him, had those back issues. Because of that, he sat out a lot of training camp." The back issues would be a huge factor in Pippen's career development and in his relationship with the front office. But his fast friendship with the Bulls' other first-round pick, Horace Grant, helped him adjust that first year. The two of them came to Chicago the next day after the draft and went to a White Sox game, Cheryl Ray Stout recalled. They were sitting in the dugout with their Bulls caps on. They forged a friendship immediately, and it translated onto the court because they felt really good about each other. They both had a lot of maturing to do. Scotty had it the most difficult coming from an NAIA school. Not being used to ever having media around, it was quite a shock for him. The relationship between the two rookies became an infatuation of sorts. Scotty is like my twin brother, explained Grant, who already had a twin brother, Harvey, also an NBA player. Pippen became his surrogate twin. The two shopped together, double-dated together, drove the same type of car, and lived near each other in suburban Northbrook. They even got married a week apart and served as each other's best man. It was the kind of relationship that cast an odd bent to the Bulls' already awkward chemistry. Scotty called in one day and skipped practice because his cat died, recalled former trainer Mark File. Horace called about 15 minutes later and said he was with Scotty because of the grieving. Johnny Bach, our assistant coach, was absolutely furious. He got Horace on the phone and said, "You get here. You ought to throw the cat in the garbage can." Horace, when the team got together, wanted to have a moment of silence for Scotty's cat. Such nonsense infuriated Jordan. Kraus recalled that practices soon became more entertaining than games in Chicago, with Jordan hunkering down and yelling at Pippen, "I'm gonna kick your ass." Early on, the goal of Jordan's harsh confrontations in practice was to toughen Pippen. Bach recalled that the young forward learned from the experience, although it didn't leave the two of them with a relationship noted for its warmth. When Scotty and Horace came in, Michael sensed the thing could be turned around, Mark File recalled. But the thing that frustrated him was that they didn't have the same attitude. They were young enough to say, "Hell, we get paid whether we win or lose," and it was good enough for them just to get close. Jordan cared only about finding some partners to help him compete. Collins took a similarly hard line, Bach explained. Doug Collins had high demand on young players, and sometimes misunderstood them. High demand with a lot of emotional involvement with them. Doug brought them to a level of competing hard every night. He drove them. He emotionally got involved with them and got them to understand how important each game and practice was, and he drove them. Some people lead young players. He drove them. Pippen continued to be troubled by his back that first season, which led some in the organization to suspect malingering, until he was finally diagnosed and underwent disc surgery during the 1988 offseason. "My first year or two, I admit that I messed around a lot," Pippen once disclosed. "I partied, enjoyed my wealth, and didn't take basketball as seriously as I should have. I'm sure a lot of rookies did the same thing I did. You're not used to the limelight or being put in a great situation financially." Even so, his talent presented great hope for the franchise, despite the fact that he weighed just 205 that first year. "Even though his body wasn't there, you could see signs," Jordan recalled. "As an open-court player, he was so much like Dr. J. He'd get the ball on the break with those long strides, and next thing you know, he's at the basket. I think it took people by surprise to see how quickly he progressed and how his body responded to the style of play." The Spat. Looking for some size and veteran leadership in the front court, the team brought back 38-year-old Artis Gilmore to share center duties with Dave Corzine. Oakley was well-established at power forward and wanted to get the ball more. Collins didn't disagree with him, but it was hard to resist the Jordan option. "We have to get to the point where Michael Jordan is not the sole source of energy on this team," Collins told reporters. "Both Michael and the Bulls know he can't survive long with the inhuman burdens we put on him. Of course, sometimes I'm not sure he's a mere human." The optimistic plan was that Pippen and Grant would earn playing time, and that Jordan could merge his overpowering talents with the developing abilities of his teammates. "We have not proven anything yet," Collins told reporters. "Last year, we were overachievers that played on emotion. Oakley's rebounding, Jordan's scoring, Paxson's steadiness, Corzine's toughness all fell into place and allowed us to be average." The season hadn't even started before trouble boiled up. In late October, Jordan accused Collins of cheating on the score of a scrimmage and walked out of practice. Headlines informed the city that the two weren't speaking. Jordan was fined and Collins found himself under pressure to make the next move. Michael in the early days was both ambitious and strong-willed, Bach reflected. Doug Collins also had a flashpoint. "With that flashy personality and drive, I could see that at times it could rub a player the wrong way, especially someone like Michael Jordan." "He has his pride, I have mine," Jordan told reporters. "We're two adults. In due time, words will be said. I'm not going to rush the situation." Doug knew he had to kiss and make up, and that's what he did, John Paxson recalled. He had to calm his superstar. That was a little test he had. Had another player done that, you don't know what would have happened, because guys just don't walk out of practice, just don't take off. While the two soon patched up in public, the reality was that Jordan had little respect for his coach. Over the years, Collins would prove his stature in the game, but at that time he was immature, Sonny Vaccaro explained. He just wasn't ready, it was obvious. Jordan sometimes vented his frustration to Vaccaro about the coach. There were situations that led Krause to caution Collins about his behavior. There were suspicions that the GM was keeping track of the coach's indiscretions. They had clashed mightily that spring and off-season regarding player acquisitions. The blow-up over practice only added to Collins's already substantial insecurities. The coach was torn. He believed that Jordan dominated the ball too much for the team to win a championship. Jordan continued to force the point guards off the ball on the inbounds and take it himself to control the offense. It meant that the coach could never get the Bulls into any sort of running game. The situation led Krause to believe that Collins was incapable of saying no to Jordan. It's got to be very difficult as a head coach to have a relationship with Michael and try to have that same type of relationship with other players, John Paxson observed almost a decade later. You just can't do it. You have to give Michael leeway. On the floor, you can't be as critical of him as you can with other players because of what he can do and what he means. Impulsive and emotional, Collins revealed a tendency to blame his players for losses, sometimes in bitter, caustic terms that only alienated them. Teammates began encouraging Jordan to speak up about these issues, but he declined, pointing to the public furor that Magic Johnson stirred in 1982 by taking on Lakers head coach Paul Westhead. As a head coach, you're walking a fine line with Michael Jordan, Paxson said looking back. Not that he would ever do anything like that. But we all knew about the situation with Magic Johnson and Paul Westhead at the Lakers, when Westhead got fired after disagreeing with Magic. That's the power Michael could have wielded if he chose to. So Doug was walking a fine line. Early in Doug's career, he handled it the best way he knew how. The result was a rift in the Jordan-Collins relationship that Jordan worked hard to mask. Some thought the player and coach were reasonably close. They were not, Vaccaro said. It was water and oil. I knew that. Jordan also took exception to Collins's antics during games, which contrasted sharply with the dignified calm that he so appreciated in Dean Smith. Many in the organization fed on Collins's zany energy. Jordan found it almost distasteful, but he kept that to himself because so many fans considered it an important part of the exciting young team. Doug was such an intense guy, recalled longtime Bulls equipment manager John Ligmanowski. It was almost like he wanted to be in the game. He'd come downstairs soaked in sweat, totally drained after a game. It was fun because we were just really starting to get good. The team had come around. Whatever his youthful shortcomings, Collins had the energy to drive the Bulls through the next stage of growth. Doug was a great guy, Mark File explained. He was interested in everything about people. He cared about them. Cheryl Ray Stout recalled that the media, particularly TV reporters, loved Collins. He was very accessible to them. Doug was screaming and yelling and jumping and throwing. He definitely was demonstrative in his actions, and the guys who were key to this team were extremely young. Horace and Scotty, they hated him. He was growing up with them. He was new to the job. Here's a guy who came from the television booth. He was learning the process, too. If Jordan felt any recrimination about the October incident with Collins, it was because he had begun, sometimes even more than his mother already did, to process things that happened to him in terms of his image, which had become the basis of his income. He acknowledged as much to Detroit reporter Jonette Howard in an interview several weeks later. I felt bad that I did it that way, he said of walking out. But I felt good that people perceived it the way it really was, that I'm just such a competitor. This was becoming his go-to excuse for just about any behavior that might be interpreted as unseemly. It was because he was such a tremendous competitor. Blaming his own excessively competitive nature was a convenient out and, more importantly, the public seemed hungry to accept it. Even so, he had plenty of reason for concern about his image, he told Howard. I'm put in a tough position with this team. It's hard for me to be a vocal leader with this team because everyone seems to view the Chicago Bulls as Michael Jordan's team or Jordan and Company. My name is always in the spotlight, and some people are naturally going to get jealous. He worried that his treatment of his teammates in practice would be viewed as harsh, so he tried to keep things balanced, he explained. If you show some tenderness and concern, people appreciate you more. He made a habit of trying to praise his teammates regularly in his media interviews. Collins was popular in Chicago, and Jordan took pains after the practice incident to show him the proper respect. The coach had been rewarded with a contract extension, but some observers saw signs that the pressure was taking its toll on him. He had lost weight, wasn't eating well, and on many days looked drawn. Jordan was also stressed, a situation ironically made worse by his financial success. The money and status continued to irritate players around the league. They had heard about his promotional contracts and saw his expensive suits and his gold necklaces. At the time, there were as many as 24 NBA players who made more than $1 million a year, while Jordan was locked into a contract that paid him about $830,000 for 1987-88. Sonny Vaccaro recalled that Magic Johnson never could understand how Jordan could have a shoe contract so much larger than any other star's. Vaccaro heard similar complaints from players all the time. He was now well known as Nike's money man, and it was his job to listen and to talk with the players in the game. Lacey Banks heard it too. The Sun-Times had assigned Banks to cover the Bulls that fall of 1987. Banks was also a Baptist minister and thus sometimes called the Reverend by those he worked with. He too was struck by Jordan's unusual relationship with wealth. "When I started covering Michael, he was still evolving," Banks remembered. "He hadn't even gotten a big contract yet. He had this principle that he signed his contract with Reinsdorf and he felt duty-bound. If Reinsdorf wanted to break it and give him some money, he wouldn't turn it down. But he didn't feel it was his place to say, 'I think I'm worth more money now. I think you ought to pay me.'" Jordan was making so much off the court, his basketball pay became a matter of pride. He didn't want to be seen as clamoring for more. The off-court income allowed him to say he didn't really play for the money. Others had said the same thing over the years, but Jordan was the first pro player who really didn't have to focus on his NBA salary. Banks had covered Muhammad Ali for Ebony magazine and had gotten to know him, and he often contemplated just how misunderstood the boxer was. Ali had displayed tremendous courage in speaking out against the Vietnam War well before that became commonplace, and he had paid dearly for his opposition to the war. This young basketball prince that Banks was now covering showed no such concern for social justice. Yet, like most of the other people reporting on Jordan, Banks found that he admired the Bulls star. "I could see that he appreciated the fact that there was a black guy covering the Bulls," Banks recalled in 2011. "We were very close the first few years." The two would often sit together, playing cards and talking, on the commercial flights the team took in those early years. And so many times when Jordan didn't have his entourage on the road, Banks would be there to fetch orange juice and oatmeal cookies for Jordan after games, since the fans in the lobby made getting them himself an impossibility. They'd sit up until the wee hours, watching movies on Spectrovision or playing yet more cards. That's when Banks came to the conclusion that Jordan had a photographic memory. He could quote entire sections of movie scripts and could recall amazing details of the endless blur of games he played. "I came to believe he was counting cards on me," Banks said of their titanic games of 7 and 5 card stud and tonk. "He could call every bet, at least 90% of them. I was playing to try to win money. He was playing for relaxation and competition. In many ways, he fascinated me. Michael was a dream, and I had a nice, meaningful, enriching, enjoyable relationship with him. He would be unfailingly polite with any woman who knocked on his hotel door late at night seeking affection. That was before I realized he had a secret life going on," Banks explained. "They were together so often in those early days that people began calling me Michael's man," Banks explained. "That made me feel good and massaged my ego. Especially with so many beautiful women wanting to meet Jordan. 'You know Michael? Can you introduce me to him?' they would ask Banks, who always politely declined." The sportswriter found Jordan amazingly patient, not just with women, but with the many strangers they encountered in airports and hotels. "He wouldn't brush people off," Banks said. Jordan drew much of his approach from his parents. "They were quiet but sociable," Banks said. There was a tremendous resemblance between his father and Michael, their facial expressions and speech patterns. "Mrs. Jordan was a devout Christian. I never heard anything untoward about his mother or father or his siblings." The sportswriter spent time pondering how Jordan was misunderstood, not by the public as much as by his peers in the game. "When people begrudged him his success, they didn't understand," Banks recalled. "People thought he was being arrogant wearing the bling, and they begrudged him not so much for his talent, but more for his marketing success. To have a multi-million-dollar contract with Nike was unheard of. What we all saw was that this guy is a marketing magnet, and whoever had a piece of him was going to do well. The Bulls started drawing a capacity crowd, leading the league in attendance. Michael became king of the court. It was a coronation that both opponents and certain people in the Bulls organization eyed with disdain." Chapter 21, Ruling Jordan. The Bulls opened the season in October 1987 with Brad Sellers, their first-round pick in 1986, at small forward, ancient Artis Gilmore at center, and Oakley at power forward. Jordan and John Paxson were the guards. Collins and management had agreed that Jordan needed to play fewer minutes and to share the responsibility with his teammates, but just the opposite occurred. Collins saw that Jordan wasn't going to allow the running game to happen, so he ran isolation plays for Jordan again and again, which consistently confounded the opposition. For Jordan, 1988 would be a season of adjustment. His quickness to the basket was so great that teams had to force him to take jump shots and push him to give up the ball. The league had no rules against hand-checking and physical play in that era, so coaches started looking around for people strong enough to muscle him. Jordan worked on his outside shot, so as not to present a weakness that could be used against him. But he maintained that he was a much better shooter than people gave him credit for. There was no team focused on Jordan quite like Detroit. The 1987 playoffs had been a watershed of sorts for the Pistons, who had battled for several years to unseat Bird Celtics in the playoffs. They finally had what seemed like the edge in Game 5 of the 1987 Eastern Conference Finals in Boston Garden with a one-point lead over the Celtics and scant seconds to go. The Pistons were inbounding the ball along the sideline near their own basket, and Isaiah Thomas wanted the ball from referee Jess Kersey. "Don't you want a timeout?" Kersey asked. "Just give me the fucking ball," Thomas shouted over the noise. So the referee gave Thomas the ball. He passed it in, then Bird stole it and hit streaking Celtics teammate Dennis Johnson for the go-ahead basket. Like that, Boston had a one-point lead with a second left. Kersey turned to a crushed Thomas. "Now do you want a timeout?" the referee asked. In the aftermath, there was no good means to measure the depth of despair for Thomas and his teammates. They had also been deflated by Jordan scoring those 61 points to beat them in the Pontiac Silverdome. Detroit's coaches knew they would have to come up with a special effort to stop him in 1988. The Pistons were a team bent on breaking through. The Bulls and Jordan were clearly becoming a greater threat in the Central Division. Detroit coach Chuck Daly and his assistants began searching for a means to counter Jordan, and guard Joe Dumars was now at the center of their plans. Dumars, in turn, was fairly obsessed with the challenge. "More than anybody else, that was the game I looked forward to," he said of playing the Bulls. "Chicago, I looked forward to that game, because he was so great that whatever greatness I had in me was going to have to be there that night." Jordan and Dumars had much in common. "Southern, respectful," said Dumars in a 2012 interview. "These people, both families, taught the same thing. Respect people, carry yourself with some dignity, with some class and some character, and you stand on that. You don't waver." Where Jordan idolized his great-grandfather Dawson, Dumars worshipped his father, Big Joe, who had served in General George Patton's army in World War II. Like Jordan, Dumars grew up playing on a court built by his old man, across the street from the largest liquor store in Natchitoches, Louisiana. The store had giant floodlights that used to shine on the Dumars' backyard, illuminating the goal. Joe would often shoot alone until late at night when his father got home from his long workdays as a truck driver. Dumars, too, was at first overlooked by basketball scouts. He wound up at McNeese State, a small liberal arts school in Lake Charles, Louisiana, in the midst of Cajun country. Also a starter from his freshman year, Dumars averaged 26.4 points his junior season, 1983-84, enough to finish sixth in the NCAA Division I scoring race. Like Jordan, Dumars broke a metatarsal bone in his foot, and like Jordan, he took charge of his own rehab and began playing, contrary to medical advice. The same age as Jordan, Dumars stayed a year longer in college but followed Jordan's career intently, first at North Carolina, then as a rookie for the Bulls. Jordan's foot injury meant that he was out much of Dumars's rookie season, so they had only a brief encounter that spring of 1986. "I was really interested to see how good this guy really is," Dumars recalled. "I think he had 33 points, and I remember this explosion, this athleticism, and you just go, wow." By the time they began competing head-to-head in the fall of 87, their similarities had lessened. After all, Jordan had blown up into a household name, and Dumars was still one of the best-kept secrets in the NBA. He played in the shadow of Isaiah Thomas in the backcourt of the Pistons, and was known as an exceptional defender. He could score as much as his team needed and was a fine ball handler. Mostly, he went about his business quietly, which was remarkable considering the Pistons were the Bad Boys, a rough, profane club that had used a very physical style to push their way up the standings. Dumars recalled that Isaiah Thomas's focus on Chicago only added to the intensity they all felt. Thomas had grown up in the Windy City on the hard streets of the West Side. It was always about going back to Chicago, Dumars said of Thomas's mindset before each game against the Bulls. He was like, that's my hometown. I don't want to lose going back to Chicago. And then, having that kind of superstar in there in Michael, Isaiah was focused. Center James Edwards, who was a teammate of both Jordan and Thomas over his long career, said that for all their differences, the two men shared something essential. They both were very driven to be the best they could be. Isaiah was fired up everywhere, but of course he was fired up when he went home. It didn't take much to get him going. He was always on fire, no matter where we played. With the hard feelings from the freeze-out of the 1985 All-Star Game fresh in Jordan's memory, the confrontations between the Bulls and Pistons always threatened to boil over. Those games were intense, emotional, Dumars said. It could be the middle of January, but it was always like the playoffs, incredible intensity. Everybody was emotional in those games. Nobody wanted to lose, and we would sit there with tears in our eyes when we didn't win. I'm fortunate and blessed that I played in that kind of atmosphere. In another subplot, Brendan Malone, Jordan's five-star coach, joined the Pistons staff. Off the court, Malone would spend time with Jordan and his parents at retreats hosted by Nike. By the time he went to work for the Pistons, Malone had spent a couple of years in the league scouting Jordan closely. I'd go to the old Chicago Stadium and watch the games, he said, and I knew the last 8 minutes was Jordan time. If he had 30 after the third quarter, I knew he was going to have 50. If he had 20 points after the third quarter, he was going to have 40. He took over in the last 8 minutes of the game. What's so remarkable about Michael Jordan, and I've watched a lot of games, he never took a game off. He never took a possession off. He always played hard. Especially against the Pistons. Both teams knew they were headed for a showdown in 1988. Chicago jumped out to a 10-3 start, which earned Collins Coach of the Month honors for November and lifted Jordan's spirits. The feeling spread across the roster and breathed early life into what would come to be known as the Jordan Swagger. Ping pong. In the early days, he practiced that swag on Lacey Banks. Their game of choice was table tennis. Jordan had taken up the indoor game early in his Chicago days in a fit of competition with Rod Higgins. Banks was older and heavy-set and sweated profusely when they played. The competition had gotten going one day at the Deerfield Multiplex, where the Bulls practiced, when Banks mentioned that he was good at the game. You can't play ping pong, Jordan told him. They picked up the paddles to play, and Jordan said, let's make this interesting, 25 a game. Banks won the first 7 games and ran up some healthy winnings. He immediately noticed Jordan was reluctant to pay up, saying instead they'd keep playing and run a tab. He never really paid me, Banks recalled. Michael is a Welsher. He bought a table and started practicing. Soon they were playing before a varied audience at the multiplex. Banks had also begun betting with Jordan when the team went on the road. On one occasion, the reporter lost $100 to the rich young star by cutting cards on the plane for $20 a turn. Banks arrived back at the airport in Chicago and had to borrow his losses back from Jordan just to get his car out of the parking garage. The sports writer's plan was to dig out of debt with ping pong one day after Bulls practice at the multiplex. Things looked good for the reporter when he won the first 6 games, but typical of his scouting report, Jordan wanted to keep playing as a small crowd gathered. Banks agreed, and like that, Jordan won 2 quick games and started talking. Don't ever think you can dominate me, he said. Never. I done figured you out, Lacey. The more he won, the more he poured on the trash talk. Chase that ball, Lacey. Run, run. Get it, Lacey. I got you now. The very last time they played, Jordan won all 7 games, Banks recalled. He chalked me up as another conquest. I said, let's play for fun. He wouldn't do it. Michael Jordan and the Reverend were unlikely sparring partners, playing ping pong at the old multiplex, sometimes playing cards, arguing often, noted Trib basketball writer Sam Smith. Jordan was famous, hedonistic, rich beyond belief. Banks was spiritual, middle class, humble. And to the very end, the Reverend asked Jordan questions in news conferences that made MJ squirm. He had a gusto for living, Banks said in 2011 of the young Jordan. He had this tremendous personality of energy, of humor, the energy of competition, and the energy of daring. Certainly it was unlike any I had ever seen. When I was covering Ali, and I covered Ali before I covered Jordan, Ali was an oddity, a freak of nature as it were, a guy that big who could dance like a ballerina and could hit like a blacksmith. Even with covering a guy like Ali, I had never seen anybody with that inhuman amount of energy like Michael had. It was taking every ounce of that energy to turn the Bulls around. A 5-game losing streak in late December dipped them back toward 500 as their faith in Gilmore evaporated. The team released him before Christmas. January brought a colossal fistfight with the Pistons in Chicago Stadium and a rare win in the series for the Bulls. The melee erupted in the third quarter after Jordan grabbed an offensive rebound and faked Detroit's Rick Mahorn and Adrian Dantley on the putback. Mahorn hooked Jordan around the neck and threw him to the ground, the Associated Press reported, after which Jordan and teammate Charles Oakley went after Mahorn, with both benches clearing onto the floor. Collins tried to intervene as Mahorn landed two rights to Oakley's face. Mahorn then turned on Collins, Bulls trainer Mark Phil recalled. There was a tussle in front of our bench and Doug Collins tried to grab Ricky Mahorn. Hell, Ricky threw Doug down twice, threw him down on the floor. Doug jumped back up and Ricky threw him over the scorer's table. Those were the things that always stood out in our minds. The Pistons were constantly doing those kinds of things. They just constantly beat and battered you. There is no doubt in my mind that both Mahorn and Dantley were attempting to injure me, not just prevent me from scoring, and that's what infuriated me, Jordan told reporters afterward. But Detroit thinks they can intimidate us, and while Mahorn and Dantley had every right to prevent me from getting an easy 2 points, it did not give them the right to purposely try to injure me and knock me out of the game. Oakley and Mahorn were ejected, but Chicago had stood up to the intimidation. The Bulls always seemed a little intimidated by the Pistons, except for Michael, Phil said. And he was always trying to get it across to the guys that this is the team we have to bridge ourselves over to get to the next level. Sometimes it took some yelling to get his point across. But against the Pistons, I think that's when Michael started stepping up as a leader. But in the backs of their minds, our guys were always thinking that something dirty would happen against the Pistons. Detroit would intimidate you every time they came in your building. The Bulls zoomed off again from there on their way to a 50-32 record, the team's first 50-win season in 13 years. Jordan's mood improved, allowing for some bonding with his younger teammates. His expectations never made it easy, especially in practices, where he constantly raised the stakes. He had to push them and at the same time find little ways to help bring them along. At the end of the day, however, he remained Air Jordan. I wouldn't say he was aloof or anything, Jim Stack recalled. He just had his group of guys who had been in town since day one. Those guys just sort of followed him around like an entourage. He sort of insulated himself that way. It was interesting how he handled himself off the floor. He was still gregarious with his teammates. He just had those personal friends, and Michael was an extremely loyal guy. He had those guys with him all the time. Even so, he still made time for his teammates. It was in Phoenix in his hotel room, Lacey Banks said, recalling one such occasion, and it was Mike Brown, Scottie Pippen, Charles Oakley, and Horace Grant. Michael had a suite, and they were in there wrestling like kids and throwing each other over sofas. I was thinking, this is for members only. This was Michael's inner circle, and very few players were allowed to ascend into the inner circle, that sanctum of Michael's. They were saying things like kids would say, like, you can't beat me, corny stuff. They had the wrestler stance and they would attack like sumo wrestlers. It was a test of strength, a rite of passage. But a passage to what? Jordan still seemed committed to winning games by himself. Where they were headed and how they were going to get there was still vague. Chicago hosted the All-Star Game in February, which brought another milestone. Always meant to be a showcase for the league's talent, the event put Jordan front and center more than ever. He claimed his second slam dunk title in a narrow win over Atlanta's Dominique Wilkins, with a perfect score of 50 on his final dunk. Some observers, such as New York Daily News basketball writer Mitch Lawrence, smelled a little Chicago home cooking. I remember sitting there saying to myself, there's just no way Dominique can win this. We're in Cook County, where they steal elections, Lawrence recalled with a chuckle. But I mean, Jordan deserved it, obviously, and even Dominique admitted that, as great as he was that day. I still think Dominique had as good of a performance as you could have. The problem was the game was in Chicago, All-Star Saturday. By then, I mean, Michael had just grown in stature anyway. Sports Illustrated photographer Walter Yost had shot the 1987 dunk contest in Seattle and had come away disappointed with the images. He realized he needed different lighting and positioning to capture the faces of the competitors. He was in Chicago Stadium 3 hours before the start and approached Jordan, asking if he could tell him how and where he was going to approach the goal during each dunk. Sure, Jordan replied. I can tell you which way I'm going. He offered to put his finger on his knee before each dunk to indicate from which side he would approach the goal. Yost was dubious that Jordan would remember to signal him, but sure enough, Jordan cooperated. For the next to last dunk, Yost positioned himself immediately under the basket stanchion, and Jordan literally fell into my arms, the photographer recalled years later. On Jordan's final dunk, Yost again stood under the basket as Jordan was set to take off from the far end of the floor. Jordan looked down the court at him and motioned with his fingers for Yost to move slightly to the right. Jordan then took off, running the length of the floor to launch at the foul line for the perfect dunk. Just as Yost captured the iconic photo of Jordan flying, the ball poised to strike, his face pressed with a G-force of determination, and looming over his shoulders, the Chicago Stadium scoreboard, flashing with ads for Gatorade, Coca-Cola, and Winston cigarettes. The timing was indeed perfect. The next night, Jordan scored a record 40 points to earn the MVP honors in the All-Star game, and the media noted that Isaiah Thomas made a pronounced effort to get the ball to his airness. Jordan's final points came on an alley-oop slam dunk from Thomas. They paused afterward and pointed at each other, which proved to be little more than heavyweight contenders touching gloves before punching at the bell. The Quiet War. Nothing made Jordan see red quite like Isaiah Thomas walking onto the court before a tip-off. He emphasized that once again on national television early that April of 1988 by scoring 59 points in a 112-110 Bulls victory. His point totals against Detroit over the season had reverberated like a taunt, 49, 47, 61, and 49, against a team that prided itself on its defense. We made up our minds right then and there that Michael Jordan was not going to beat us by himself again, Chuck Daly said. We had to commit to a total team concept to get it done. The Pistons coaching staff determined to find a way to limit the Bulls' star during the fourth quarter. Detroit's strategy had always involved being physical. Isaiah and Lambeer, they wanted me to let him drive, Joe Dumars recalled. It was like, let him drive. As you know, it was a much more physical game back then, and they wanted to be physical and tough and nasty. And that's how they wanted to stop Michael. We were a very physical team with Isaiah, Rick Mahorn, and Lambeer, Brendan Malone agreed. When Michael went to the basket and tried to score a layup, he was knocked down. They put him on the floor. He never gave an inch, no matter how battered he was, former Piston James Edwards recalled in 2012. We used to put some wood on him with Lambeer and Mahorn out there. We used to punish him. He never faltered an inch. He kept going to the basket. He never stopped. He wasn't afraid of anything you did to him. The bad boys of Detroit were known to stretch the rules, which only intensified Jordan's ire. In short time, he had come to hate the Pistons and their style of play. Yet strangely, in his competitive relationship with Dumars, he took a different approach. When he came on the court, we shook hands, Dumars recalled. It was, hey Mike, how's it going? Never once in my 14 years did he ever talk trash or anything with me. It was interesting because I would see him on television with other guys, and there would be a whole lot of trash talking. I'm like, that's not the guy I play against. Never once did he trash talk or say anything derogatory to me, ever. Not one time. I knew he could get tough with those guys on the other teams. I respected that about him too. He knew this was going to be a quiet war here with me. Jordan always tested those guarding him, but Dumars remained expressionless. Jordan also had to have a plan for playing Dumars. He knew that if the Detroit guard hit his first few shots, he could have a big offensive night. Whereas Jordan tended to hang back early, especially in big games, he took a different approach with Dumars and sought to be aggressive from the start, to keep him so busy defensively that he didn't have time to get his offensive game going. Jordan let it be known that nobody in the league defended him better than Dumars, and the respect between the two men would eventually grow into friendship. He's a down-to-earth guy, not that bad boy image, Jordan once explained. He loves competing. He's behind the scenes, not vocal. He didn't go out searching for stardom or notoriety. It found him. The Detroit coaches, however, weren't much interested in friendship. They wanted to find a stronger defensive focus. To make sure there were no more outbursts against them, Chuck Daly and his assistant Ron Rothstein devised what would come to be hyped as the Jordan Rules. They respected Michael and his greatness so much, Chuck and Ronnie and those guys, I think it was the ultimate challenge for any coach to try to come up with a game plan to try to slow this guy down, Dumars explained. We were getting ready to play the Bulls one day in shoot-around. One of my favorite coaches of all time, Ronnie Rothstein, our assistant coach, is about to show me what he wants. He said, here's what Michael's doing, and here's what he's about to do. He's showing me, and Chuck stops him and says, hold on a minute, you ever guarded Michael? He does a pretty good job of it. Let him tell us how he's going to guard him, how he's going to stop him, and we'll adjust to that. Like that, the Detroit staff had decided to build their plan on what Dumars thought. It was this ability to listen that made Daly a Hall of Fame coach. They knew I was committed and passionate, Dumars said. I didn't bring the frills. There wasn't a whole lot of smoke and mirrors to what I did. They knew I was dead serious when I stepped out on that court, and I tried to establish that from the first day. The Pistons also used Dennis Rodman and Isaiah Thomas on Jordan, Brendan Malone explained, but Dumars was the primary defender. He had such quick feet and was so dedicated to playing defense. The coaches and Dumars decided that no matter what, they would not double-team Jordan early in the game, even if he was scoring 20 points in the first quarter. I didn't want him to see the double teams early and figure them out, Dumars explained. So I only wanted to double him in the fourth quarter. The coaches and Dumars also decided that they did not want to force Jordan to pass the ball early because they did not want his teammates to get comfortable catching and shooting. We said, for the first three quarters, look man, if he's rolling, that's fine. Let's just stay in the game and keep it close, Dumars recalled. Now, all of a sudden in the fourth quarter, the ball swings and his teammates have to start making shots. So I didn't want any doubles until the fourth quarter. The other primary element of the Jordan rules called for Dumars to use his strength to force Jordan left toward the center of the floor when he had the ball. I'm going to try and push him left every single time, Dumars explained. That's where the Jordan rules came in, Malone recalled. We took away all his trash, took away his drive by pushing him to the elbows, took away his baseline drive and pushed him left. And when he got the ball down on the blocks in the post, we would come from the top and double-team him. That was the Jordan rules. We did not want him to get to the baseline. On the wings, we pushed him to the elbows. We pushed him on either wing to the elbow, and we would influence him to his left. Anything less than the Jordan rules would have meant defeat, James Edwards observed. I mean, if you didn't scheme against him, he could drop 50 on you at any time. You had to try to slow him down the best way you could. You had to at least double-team him and make him pass it. You had to make it as hard as you can. You had to use two guys. You couldn't guard him one-on-one. He was too good, too quick. Asked about the Jordan rules, Detroit's John Sally once quipped, "It's really two things. When Michael gets his hands on the ball, we all get down on our knees and pray. Secondly, we all go to church or synagogue before the game." The Jordan rules succeeded against Doug Collins' Bulls so well that they became textbook for guarding athletic scorers. In the 17 regular season and playoff games between the Bulls and the Pistons over two seasons, Jordan's average would fall by nearly 8 points to 28.3 per game. Most important, the Pistons would win 14 of those games. The scheme helped Detroit break free in the Eastern Conference and win two NBA championships, but it also helped Chicago in the long run by forcing Jordan and the Bulls to find an answer to Detroit's muscle. I think that Jordan rules defense, as much as anything else, played a part in the making of Michael Jordan, Tex Winter said in 2004, looking back. Each year, the Bulls were getting better, Dumars said. It was like driving and looking in your rearview mirror. We'd say, man, they're gaining on us. They're coming. You could see them coming. It wasn't long before that Ferrari went right by. Whoosh. Most valuable. Jordan again led the league in scoring in 1988, this time with a 35.0 average, and for the first time he was named the NBA's MVP. It's a thrill, he said. The year before, he had been outpointed in the voting by Magic Johnson, who was on his way to leading the Lakers to back-to-back titles. For 88, Larry Bird finished second with 16 first-place votes to Jordan's 47. Jordan's 3.2 steals per game also led the league, and he was named Defensive Player of the Year and a member of the All-Defensive Team, fulfilling another of his goals. Krause, meanwhile, was named Executive of the Year, and Oakley again pulled down more rebounds than any player in the league, with 1,066. The biggest prize, though, was the Bulls' first playoff series win since 1981, a 3-2 defeat of the Cleveland Cavaliers. In the first two games of the series, Jordan scored 50 and 55 points. No one in NBA history, not even Wilt Chamberlain, had scored 50 points in back-to-back playoff games. In the decisive fifth game, Collins decided to move Pippen into the opening lineup for the first time. Pippen replaced the ineffective Brad Sellers and scored 24 points. Krause was overcome afterward. "This is a baby from Conway, Arkansas, upon whom we've put tremendous pressure," he told reporters. "When I played against Scotty last summer, I could see he had the skills," Jordan said. "It was just a matter of, how do you get them out of him in a season? It took 82 games for him to do it, but he's done it. And I think it's going to help him for the rest of his career." To celebrate, the Bulls donned t-shirts that said, "How do you like us now?" "We're ready for the next round," Jordan announced after the victory. At first, it seemed they were. They claimed the second game at the Pontiac Silverdome in their second-round series with the Pistons, and suddenly the Bulls had the home court advantage. But from there, the Pistons zeroed in with their late-game defense on Jordan and forced him to pass. They also resorted to their bad boy tactics. In Game 3, a 101-79 Pistons blowout in the stadium, Jordan and Detroit center Bill Laimbeer scuffled. "I set a pick," Laimbeer said. "I guess he wasn't looking." It was during this series that Los Angeles Clippers owner Donald Sterling phoned Jerry Reinsdorf and inquired about getting Jordan in a trade. Sterling badly needed the kind of player that would allow him to compete with the Lakers and Magic Johnson for the city's attention. He could offer Chicago a slew of draft picks, including two of the top six of the first round. A deal wasn't as far-fetched as it would seem in retrospect. Krause, who coveted draft picks like jewels, had begun to see that no matter how he built the team, Jordan would always get the credit for any winning. And Reinsdorf understood the criticism that the team could never win the NBA Finals with Jordan dominating the offense. The offer forced the Chicago front office to think about an alternative future without Jordan. With the right moves, it could be very attractive, Krause concluded. But Reinsdorf had already infuriated Chicago fans with his threats of moving the White Sox to Florida. Trading Jordan would have brought the wrath of the city down on his head. The owner knew he couldn't do it, and the Bulls passed. Detroit took Game 4 and was in control in Game 5 when Jordan hit Isaiah Thomas in the face with an elbow and briefly knocked him unconscious. Thomas was sent to the locker room but found the door locked. So he returned to the arena and later entered the game to provide enough edge to help the Pistons to advance 4-1. Teams had focused almost exclusively on stopping him, Jordan would say later looking back, and doing that exposed certain weaknesses on our team. Yet he didn't see the solution coming. Just before the 1988 draft, the Bulls traded Oakley to New York for center Bill Cartwright, a move that blindsided fans and players alike. Oakley was the team's primary muscle, not to mention Jordan's enforcer and closest friend on the roster. Cartwright, a 7'1" post-up center, had been plagued by foot injuries and was thought to be near the end of his career. The trade itself was bad enough, but the way it went down made it worse. Oakley was out on the town with Jordan, attending the Mike Tyson-Michael Spinks fight. "Oak was in Atlantic City with Michael at a fight, and I couldn't find him to tell him about the trade," Krause recalled. "He found out about it because somebody ran up to him at the fight and told him. He told Michael, and Michael went bananas. How in the hell could Krause do this? He's screwing up the franchise." Michael went nuts. "We were in Atlantic City watching the fight," Jordan remembered. "I was pretty upset about the deal, and also to have to find out about it that way." Jordan's wrath ignited the media and then the fans. Krause, who had taken great pride in drafting Oakley, was also deeply torn. "Charles was strong and tough and mean," Johnny Bock recalled. "He was the hardest trade that we had to do because Jerry Krause not only loved him as a player, but I think he had a great affection for him as a person. And to give him up and get Cartwright was almost against the grain. But the coaches really believed we couldn't win without Bill Cartwright, so we made the trade." "It was traumatic for the team," Bock explained, "but I think it just took us the next step up. Our defense was anchored by a real professional. Bill was good in the locker room, he was good in practice, and he earned the respect of the team because he could play Patrick Ewing straight up. We didn't have to double Patrick Ewing, and that gave us a great deal of confidence. What made the trade so tough was that Michael looked at Oakley as a protector. Charles was ready to fly into any tangle. You hit Michael, you had to face Charles. But Bill, in his own way, toughened up the big guys we had, and, in his own quiet way, Bill became very much of a Terminator. Things stopped at the basket." "It was a big gamble for this franchise, a huge gamble," Tex Winter observed later. "We were giving up a young guy for an old guy, but we felt like we needed to start with a good post-up center, particularly someone who could anchor our defense." The deal also opened up playing time for a rapidly improving Horace Grant. "We needed a guy who could clog the middle, and we weren't going to win without one," Jerry Reinsdorf said. "I also knew that Horace Grant was coming on and thought that he'd be a better player than Oakley anyway." Grant's superior quickness changed the defense. He and Pippen gave the Bulls two lightning forwards. With Grant on the floor, the Bulls could bring much more pressure to their defense. It would become a trademark. Bock took to calling Pippen and Grant the Dobermans, the attack players in the Bulls' pressure-trapping defense. But at the time, the loss of Oakley soured Jordan's mood just when pressure was growing off the court as well. Flight 23. As spring became summer, Juanita Vannoy had informed Jordan that she was pregnant, which further inflamed the ire of his parents, who suggested that she had allowed the conception to happen to secure her hold on their son. It was not a happy time, Sonny Vaccaro recalled. Meanwhile, Jordan, in partnership with Nike, had opened a small chain of retail stores that were owned in part by his family. The Flight 23 by Jordan stores were to be run by James Jordan, Vaccaro explained. They gave him something to make it look like he's making a dollar that he's not taking off his son. That was the general idea when it first happened. They said, okay, let's let James start a company. We'll have a store in Charlotte, and we'll have a store over here and over there. The enterprise also provided the Jordan siblings a share in the ownership. Their brother's instant and overpowering wealth and fame had quickly trapped them in the impossibility of arranging some sort of normal life and employment. Ronnie, with his military service and his family, already had his life and career laid out, but the others found mostly complication at every turn. You know how hard that must have been also, Vaccaro observed, to be the brother or sister of Michael Jordan, with the mother and the father having to maintain a semblance of balance where he's not just paying for everybody, which he basically ended up doing. Sadly, the running of retail outlets only served to further exacerbate the family conflicts, particularly those between James and Dolores Jordan. Michael was engaged at every turn in his young life, from the immense challenge on the court to his many business dealings to his developing relationship with Juanita. Now he had to navigate a new level of intensity between his parents. With the press and a large crowd attending the grand opening of the Flight 23 by Jordan store in Charlotte, his parents engaged in an ugly dispute in a back room of the retail space, his older sister recalled. While we were all entangled in their conflicts to a certain extent, it was Michael who was pulled into them mainly and being affected by them the most. It was he who was having to endure the private battles and step out on the platform of the world and smile, even when his heart was breaking. He once told me that the worst thing about his success was what it had done to our parents. While the public saw James Jordan as a nice, hard-working man, Nike quickly discovered that he was a nightmare running the small chain of stores. He was known to do some drinking, and he dealt with crises by ignoring them. He also ignored bills owed to suppliers, Vaccaro recalled. He wasn't paying for the t-shirts and all that. Beyond that, there was increasing evidence that he was philandering, which further fired the conflict with Dolores. James was a scoundrel, and he created a lot of problems, Vaccaro said. It was horrible. He owed money, and his kid was making zillions. As a Nike representative, Vaccaro found himself in the middle of the conflict. It was unbelievable, he said, explaining that he met separately with James Jordan and then his wife, in hopes of resolving the issues. Word of the problems had gotten to Phil Knight quickly, and the Nike chairman wanted them handled. The Jordans came to a hotel in Beverly Hills, where Vaccaro spoke to them separately. I had to talk about the problem James was having, he explained. I represented Nike because Phil could never get next to these people. I had to go down and negotiate what James was doing, and then I'd go to Dolores. Jordan dearly loved and was loyal to both his parents, which made their conflict almost unbearable for him. But he didn't take his father's side when it came to Nike, Vaccaro recalled. Jordan agreed with Phil Knight that Nike should buy out his parents' interests as soon as possible. Otherwise, the family was headed for a public relations nightmare due to James Jordan's mismanagement. The situation dragged out for 3 years while Jordan was engaged in his most intense battles with the Pistons. At first, James Jordan resisted giving up his ownership, Vaccaro recalled. He wanted to be separate, but you couldn't have a separate Flight 23 or whatever the hell he wanted to call it. When it was finally made clear that Nike was going to take the stores back, James decided to take some of the proceeds from the sale and launch his own clothing company along with son Larry. Not surprisingly, it wasn't long before that operation, too, was in trouble. That generated more conflict with Dolores Jordan and more headaches for their famous son. The public never saw the pain and the problem that existed, Sonny Vaccaro said. I was in the middle of them when they were breaking away from Nike and James got involved in buying his own t-shirts. I was in the middle of all that. After the Flight 23 by Jordan catastrophe, he vowed that he would never have any business dealings with us, Jordan's older sister said of the experience. It was worse than you or others may think, Vaccaro agreed. What made it worse, they all realized in retrospect, was that the conflict took away Jordan's family as a place where he could escape the pressures of fame, fortune, and competition. More and more, golf was becoming his means of escape. His other main discovery about his life was that even when he got away, his competitive urges and the adrenaline rushes they bred were still with him. He had long enjoyed small bets on all sorts of things, but especially golf. As the sanctuary of his personal life evaporated, he turned to golf for relief and to wagering to feed his craving for an adrenaline rush. And now that his life was larger, the bets became larger too. What he didn't fully comprehend at the time was that he was putting on the line his own good name, which he guarded so tenaciously in every other aspect of his life. He continued to groom his public image while keeping his golf gambling secret, documented only in the strange hieroglyphics of his scorecard. Soon it was hidden so well that often one of his own golf partners would have no idea of the lofty level of wagering Jordan was engaging in. The issue with his gambling, Jordan would soon discover, was not so much what it was, but what it was perceived to be. Chapter 22. Flying High and Dry. Jordan went to yet another appreciation event at Laney High during the 1988 offseason. During a break, he slipped outside for some fresh air. Dick Nayer, his old Babe Ruth coach, snuck up behind him, grabbed him by the band of his trousers and underwear, and pulled up high and hard to deliver the kind of wedgie that only an ex-Marine could fathom. It was perhaps Jordan's ultimate Haynes moment. Stunned and instantly angered, Jordan whirled around, saw who it was, and told him, "Dick Nayer, you're still the craziest white man I know." That was quite a statement, considering Jordan's relationship with Krause. During that 1988 offseason, Krause had arranged for Tex Winter and Phil Jackson to coach the Bulls' summer league team and to use Winter's triangle offense. The franchise's main team had never used the triangle under Doug Collins, but the GM wanted Winter to teach Jackson the offense. The summer league team featured few of the players the franchise had under contract and focused instead on various free agents and rookies hoping to catch on with Chicago. Doug Collins was well aware that the summer league was using Winter's offense and that Jackson was involved, but Collins didn't fully grasp that Krause would likely have supported any coach who actually listened to Winter. Doug was very headstrong and confident, which you would expect, explained Jim Stack. He had been a number one pick and had had a great NBA career. Doug really wanted to do things his way. At that young age, he sort of bucked against some ideas. Besides, anyone could see that the Bulls were getting better, driving more exciting change for the franchise. For example, the supply of Bulls season tickets was exhausted by the fall of 1988. If you wanted a ride on the Jordan Express, you had to get on the waiting list. His team coffers plump with revenue just 4 short years from the time that the Bulls seemed doomed. Jerry Reinsdorf rewarded his star with a contract extension that September, reported to be worth about $25 million over 8 seasons. This new deal, too, would be outdated in record time. They were all headed into a blizzard of cash. That season, the Bulls would lead the league in the sales of licensed merchandise, and they would do so for the foreseeable future. To put that in proper perspective, recalled longtime Bulls VP Steve Schanwald, about 40% of all NBA licensed merchandise sold was Bulls-related. If only all that money could have bought Jerry Krause a little love, or at least respite from Jordan's ballooning frustrations. The conflict. As Jordan suspected, the early returns for his fourth NBA season proved troubling. The Pistons pushed them around on opening night in Chicago. Collins had Cartwright at center, Brad Sellers and Grant at forwards, and Jordan in the backcourt with Sam Vincent, who had come to Chicago from Seattle. Faced with glaring weaknesses there, Jordan again seemed to take it all on himself and broke out of the gate on his way to leading the league in scoring, and brashness too. He stole the ball during a November game and dunked on guard Bobby Hansen, which prompted Jazz owner Larry Miller, who was sitting courtside, to snap at Jordan that he should pick on somebody his own size. Moments later, Jordan went to the hoop and dunked over 6'11 center Mel Turpin, then ran by Miller as he headed down the floor and asked the owner, "Is he big enough?" The team, meanwhile, teetered along a mediocre path. Media critics had long pointed out that Larry Bird and Magic Johnson made their teammates better, while Jordan often seemed to be playing for himself. Assistant coach Phil Jackson had articulated a similar point one day about the need for Jordan to make his teammates better. Jackson said it was something Knicks coach Red Holzman had emphasized to him years earlier. Collins thought Jackson had a good point and ordered his assistant to go and inform Jordan of it immediately. Jackson took on the foolhardy mission, fully expecting an unwelcome response from the star. He was surprised, however, that Jordan listened with patience and seemed to appreciate the honesty, no matter how much the public discussion of it irritated him. Jordan's recollection of the moment had him rolling his eyes as the assistant coach walked away. Jordan was beginning to grow as a team leader, although it wasn't a warm and fuzzy kind of leadership. It was mostly the pressure he put on his teammates to be good or be gone. Now, however, he was headed into the season fearing that Krause had just made a terrible trade for Cartwright that would make the team weaker and Jordan's job all the more difficult. At the beginning of the year, it was frustrating and hard to accept, Jordan recalled. Things were not going well, and it was getting to me. I had very high expectations, just like everyone, but there was a transition period we had to go through. The coaches, however, had seen Cartwright's value, not only as a defender, but as a leader. Jackson began calling Cartwright Teach, and the name stuck. On the court, his teammates and opponents around the league knew Cartwright for his elbows. He held them high when he rebounded or boxed out. Michael really didn't know Bill Cartwright as a person, Krause recalled. Michael made Bill prove himself. Michael did that with everybody. That was Michael's way. I knew what Bill was. Bill was going to be fine with Michael. I told Bill, it's coming. He's going to needle you. Michael's going to drive you crazy. Bill said, he ain't going to do nothing to me. It would prove complicated, former teammate John Paxson recalled. Michael demanded nothing less than playing hard. If you missed shots when you were open, he didn't want to see that either. If Michael came off the screen and roll a couple of times and threw a quick pass to Bill Cartwright and he couldn't handle it, Michael wasn't going to go there again. That was kind of what happened early. If you do something and one of your teammates doesn't respond to it, you're going to think twice about going there. It's a natural thing. You always sensed with Michael that he was looking for perfection out of himself. There's a part of him that expected that of those around him, too. If Jordan wasn't great almost every night, it was hard for the Bulls to win, so it only made sense that he wanted more out of his teammates. They all did. I feel I'm very observant about the game, he said of his approach. If things were going well, I didn't have to score too much. I could stay in the background and get everyone else involved. It was imperative that his teammates be able to do their share, Paxson explained. Michael challenged guys, and for some, their game didn't live up to that challenge. Brad Sellers, for example. It was tough for him to handle what Michael expected of him. Michael had a tendency to look at certain guys and say, "You're capable of doing this. Why aren't you? I look at your physical skills. Why can't you?" Jordan made a connection with Paxson as a teammate, although the guard from Notre Dame was not physically or athletically imposing. Jordan often rated athleticism second to heart. He said he wanted teammates with a fearlessness to step up at crucial moments. Just as important, Paxson didn't need the ball in his hands, which removed one potential conflict. "I'm sure he looked at me many times and said, 'You're not capable of doing that on the floor,'" Paxson explained. "But I had an advantage with Michael in our basketball relationship. We spent a month overseas together when we were in college as part of an international team. I made a shot to win a game over in Yugoslavia, and I've got to believe that in the back of his mind, Michael remembered that about me as a player. He was able to trust me. At the same time, I don't remember Michael early on putting any pressure on Scottie Pippen or Horace. He knew that a lot of guys have to grow into the league. Michael was always more than fair with me. He was always positive with me and never said anything negative about me in the papers. That meant a lot to me. You can get batted down when the great player of the team says something critical of you personally. He didn't do that. I thought early on he was too reserved toward players at times. I'm sure he felt he was walking a fine line. Should I be critical? Should I just lay back and let these guys do their own thing? I felt the more vocal he became as a leader, the better we were. Once he really started challenging guys, it made us better. We had to learn how to play with Michael, as well as Michael had to learn to play with us. The point guard. January found the Bulls struggling to stay above 500 and slipping into yet more conflict. Collins chafed at the assistants that Krause had hired for him. "I was upset because Doug basically wasn't listening to Tex," Krause explained, "and he wasn't listening to Phil Jackson. Doug did a great job for us for a couple of years. He took the heat off me from a public relations standpoint. Doug was great with the media. But he learned to coach on the fly, and he didn't listen to his assistants as much as he should have. Doug had a thing with Phil, too. As time went on, he was like Stan in that he got away from what we wanted to do." 3 weeks into the season, Juanita Vanoy had given birth to a boy, Jeffrey Michael, but Jordan's parents still opposed their son marrying the mother of his child. The birth of the baby was kept hush-hush throughout the season. Some writers knew about it, but kept it out of their reports. Vanoy supposedly contemplated a paternity suit for about 6 months, but ultimately decided to hold off. The tension was as thick in his personal life as it was in the locker room. Finally, in late January, the team began a turnaround thanks to the improvement of Pippen and Grant, as Jordan began stepping up the pressure on them. "I think Michael saw what kind of players Scottie and Horace could be," explained Will Perdue, a rookie backup center that season, "and he was very difficult on them at that time. He did it in a positive way, but at the same time he was challenging them to see if they would answer the challenge. Complicating the chemistry was Jordan's continued exasperation with Cartwright, who was one of the few who stood up to the bullying and intimidation, Jim Stack remembered. Some would later describe the center's intense dislike of Jordan's tactics as something that approached hatred. Bill felt that Michael chastised him unnecessarily at times, Stack said in a 2012 interview. Bill was a guy with a lot of pride. He had built a lot of respect in the league. Stack didn't think the dislike reached the level of hatred on Cartwright's part, but Perdue seemed certain that Jordan hated Cartwright. Perdue was pretty sure Jordan disliked him as well. As for the enmity sent his way, Cartwright seemed to take it in stride. He had been the kind of player in New York who could average 20 points and 10 rebounds, Stack pointed out, adding that Jordan didn't seem to recognize the sacrifice Cartwright was obviously willing to make in becoming a role player in Chicago. Bill appreciated totally Michael's talent, Stack recalled, but at the same time, Bill wasn't just going to accept his crap. Michael would test everybody. In practice, if Michael came to the hole, Bill was there to meet him. So many of the players before Bill Cartwright would totally acquiesce and defer to Michael, but Bill would take no shit. Michael could walk over just about anybody because he was so overwhelming with his talent. But Bill held his line. He said, "This is my domain in here, and you stay out there." And it had a galvanizing effect on the team. Bill was respected in the locker room for kind of standing up to Michael in a lot of ways, which was appreciated by everybody. In March, Collins grew unhappy with the play of point guard Sam Vincent and benched him. The coach moved Jordan to the point, putting the ball in his hands even more than it already was. Craig Hodges, who had played for Winter at Long Beach State, was inserted into the starting lineup as the off-guard. "It'll be interesting to see how Michael likes it," Collins said. Jordan responded by turning in 7 straight triple-doubles. He would record 14 triple-doubles between January and April, and the Bulls won 6 straight. Collins, it seemed, was positioning him to play the game the way Oscar Robertson had played it. Jordan took to checking his stats with the official scorekeeper during games, so that he would know just what he needed to ring up another triple-double. Soon, the league grew wise to what he was doing and ordered scorekeepers to stop providing in-game updates. Then Hodges was lost for the rest of the regular season with an ankle injury, and the Bulls soon lost 6 in a row. The outspoken Winter had opposed Jordan's move to the point, and discord on the coaching staff mounted until Collins barred Winter from practice. Tex was basically out of the picture at that time, Jackson recalled. Krause wondered whether Collins might just wear the superstar out with all the extra duty. As an assistant coach, Jackson quietly observed that Jordan was being worked so hard that he was too tired down the stretch of some games. Jordan didn't particularly care for playing the point, but he had little trust in his teammates' ability to score. And it was hard not to admire the work Jordan did as a one guard, where his ball handling allowed him to dance into spaces on the floor that opponents could never seem to reach in time. He would stop and start, hesitate and go, making every possession a workout on the defender's ankles. He learned quickly how to come off screens. Jordan was so elusive that help defenders had trouble just tracking him down for a double team. He drew so much attention that Hodges, Pippen, and Paxson usually found themselves wide open for threes. Jordan worked the perimeter too, and his jumper fell off in that spring, which forced defenders to make themselves even more vulnerable and step out on him. Chicago finished at 47-35 for 5th place in the conference, which earned the Jordanaires a first-round playoff matchup with the 4th-seeded Cavaliers, who had lost but 4 home games the entire season. Jordan had taken to listening to Anita Baker that spring, playing her song, "Giving You the Best That I Got," before games for inspiration. He would need it. The Bulls had lost all 6 regular season games against the Cavaliers, but that didn't stop Lacey Banks from boldly predicting a Chicago victory in the 5-game playoff series. When other Chicago writers expressed doubt that the Bulls could survive, Jordan angrily challenged them and forecast a win in 4 games. Even casual observers could see that Cleveland had the size both inside and on the perimeter in Ron Harper and Craig Elo to slow Jordan down. The Cavaliers held home court advantage, but Chicago moved to a surprising 2-1 series lead and had a chance to close it out in the stadium in Game 4. Jordan scored 50 points but missed a late free throw, and Cleveland escaped in overtime to tie the series. He seemed devastated by the turn of events, but then tossed the self-doubt off quickly. Jackson recalled that when Jordan showed up the next day for the team flight to Cleveland, he virtually bounded down the aisle, telling his teammates to have no fear. They were going to win. That enthusiasm burned right through Game 5 the following day. Jordan came out scoring and dishing, matching the Cavaliers bucket for bucket. Hodges and Paxson also stepped in to make a barrage of threes, and the game wound its way to a tight fourth quarter that produced six lead changes in the final 3 minutes. With 6 seconds to go, Jordan drove hard to his right at the top of the key. Elo reached across to stop him and was rewarded with a staggering blow to the face as Jordan scored to put Chicago up 99-98. Elo recovered to inbound the ball, then got it back and rolled in for a layup to give Cleveland a 199 lead with 3 seconds left. During the timeout, Collins quickly drew up a play for center Dave Corzine to take the last shot, with a logic that it wouldn't be expected. Jordan reacted by angrily whacking the clipboard and telling his coach, "Just give me the fucking ball." Collins quickly drew up a new look with Brad Sellers inbounding. As he walked on the floor, Jordan whispered to teammate Craig Hodges that he was going to make the shot. Cleveland coach Lenny Wilkins had planned to use forward Larry Nance's height to deny Jordan, but he slipped free, took the pass, and motored into the key for a jumper. Elo quickly picked him up and played textbook defense, on him every step until Jordan moved past him and rose up. Elo recovered, flying from the right, left arm outstretched to challenge the shot with an extended hand. But Jordan's elevation and hang time secured the moment. Elo had a hand in front of the ball, but his momentum carried him to the left as he fell away, and the form in red continued rising, reaching his apex, then swishing the game winner 101-100, which ignited his famous fist-pumping celebration, replayed a trillion times over the ensuing years. The moment was immediately dubbed the shot. Krause's first thought while watching from the stands was that Brad Sellers had delivered a perfect inbounds pass that made the play possible. "That was the best pass I ever saw in basketball," he said in 2011. "He got that pass between three guys, really threaded the needle. I ran down on the floor and hugged Brad Sellers." It was telling that in that moment, Krause had wanted to embrace his beleaguered draft pick. In 1986, Jordan had lobbied for the drafting of Duke's Johnny Dawkins, but Krause had taken Sellers instead, which became yet another bone of contention as Sellers struggled to fit in. It was certainly a fine pass, but perhaps nothing would better encapsulate the coming troubles. Krause and Jordan viewed the moment of euphoria from opposing perspectives. They were two willful, overbearing figures whose success was growing and spreading between them like a no man's land. As for Sellers, he would be gone from the Bulls after the season. Once a starter, he had averaged just 4 points and played just 13 minutes per game over the playoffs. Meanwhile, another piece of videotape from the game would also gain notoriety. The tape was a shot of the Bulls bench after Jordan's 44 points delivered the victory and had captured the beat writers sitting nearby, including Sam Smith and Bernie Lincecum of the Tribune and Lacey Banks of the Sun-Times. You see a shot of Doug Collins celebrating, and then Lacey's like jumping up and down and waving his fists over his head, recalled ESPN's J.A. Adonde, who had worked with Banks at the Sun-Times. There was a bit of Bulls fan in Lacey, you know, and it clearly came out in that moment, but he never let it cloud his journalistic duty. Banks, the one journalist to challenge Jordan consistently, had been caught in a sudden, comical lapse of objectivity. He had something on the line, having predicted a Chicago win, but the moment spoke of an industry deeply conflicted by its adulation of Air Jordan. It would become increasingly difficult for the business of sports journalism to find any sort of restraint in an era where the moments, and the media profits, were becoming exceptional. For Cleveland, meanwhile, the loss was devastating. Cavaliers center Brad Doherty, Jordan's teammate from college, had seen it before. "I saw him go up," Doherty said, "and I turned to box out, to look for the flight of the ball. I didn't see it, because Michael pumped, then brought it down. Then he went back up and hit the bottom of the net. I still don't know how he fit all of that into 3 seconds." "We're going to New York, baby," an exuberant Jordan said afterward. The energy from the win carried into the second round, where the Bulls went at it with coach Rick Pitino's Knicks, featuring Patrick Ewing, Charles Oakley, and Mark Jackson. With Jordan averaging 35 points despite playing with an aggravated groin injury, the Bulls took a surprising 3-2 edge into Game 6 in Chicago Stadium. Midway during the contest, Scottie Pippen and New York's Kenny Walker were ejected for a brief flurry of punches. It was a major blow for Chicago, and it came just as Jordan was working his way through a 40-point 10-assist effort. The Bulls seemed to have things in their grasp with a 111-107 lead with just 6 seconds left. But the Knicks' Trent Tucker hit a three-pointer, drew the foul, and completed a 4-point play to tie it in a sequence that left Collins gasping on the sidelines, as if he couldn't get enough oxygen. MJ now found himself hoping that he could produce yet another miracle, a sequel to his act in